Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 183 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. If I asked you to name three characters from Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, chances are that somewhere in your three, if not at the very top, would be one of the most influential characters in English literature. Alison, the wife of Bath. This unfiltered, opinionated, and joyful pilgrim stands out from the Canterbury crowd, interjecting, interrupting, and endearing herself to readers for over six centuries. What makes her so fascinating? And how has she endured and evolved in the popular imagination in the time since Chaucer lifted his pen? This week, I spoke with Dr. Marion Turner about the life and legacy of this legendary literary figure. Marion is the J.R.R. Tolkien Professor of English Literature and Language and chair of the English Faculty Board at Oxford University. Her books include Chaucerian Conflict, Languages of Antagonism in Late 14th Century London, A Handbook of Middle English Studies, and Chaucer, A European Life. This year, she'll be curating a major exhibit called Chaucer Here and Now at the Bodleian Library, as well as releasing a book to go along. But today, we'll be talking about her latest book, The Wife of Bath, a biography. Just a quick reminder before we begin that The Wife of Bath's tale itself does involve a discussion of sexual assault. So if you're not in a space, physically or otherwise, where you can listen to this episode today, that's okay. Feel free to come back to it another time. My conversation with Marion Turner about Alison, her many lives within the Canterbury Tales, and her many lives beyond them is coming up right after this. Well, thank you, Marion, for joining me to talk about The Wife of Bath. This is very exciting because I think there are a lot of people who are Wife of Bath fans in general. So thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I think you're right. Almost everyone says, oh, she's my favorite character from Chaucer, or she's the only one that people really remember, which is really interesting.
Yeah, she's so much bigger than just the Canterbury Tales. But as I was telling you a minute ago, I never want to assume that people already know anything about anything. So let's just situate the Canterbury Tales for people. When was it written? And tell us a little bit about the way it was written. Where does it fit in Chaucer's life?
Yeah, sure. So Geoffrey Chaucer was born in the 1340s, just before a really big pandemic hit. So We can all relate to that. And he died in 1400. So in the 14th century, he lived through this really interesting time of social change after the plague, when there were more opportunities for the people who survived. Wages went up. There was the same amount of labor that needed to be done, but, you know, half the amount of people to do it, essentially. And it was also a time when a lot more literature was being written in English, when we see a kind of rise of English more. So in the past, most texts have been written in Latin or French in England. And now authors were writing in English, whether this was government treatises or legal documents, medical texts, lots of things are happening in English now, especially poetry. So Chaucer wrote a few other poems starting maybe the early 1370s, maybe a bit earlier. And the Canterbury Tales, he started probably around the late 1380s and was working on until he died. He didn't finish it. So he was working on it until he died in 1400, though he also wrote some other things along the way. You know, he kind of would stop and start, write chunks of it, I think circulate chunks to his friends. And the Wife of Bath's prologue and tale is part of the Canterbury Tales.
Right. I think maybe not everyone realizes, if they're assigned it in school or anything like that, that it is unfinished, because That's a kind of a big part. This work is so canonical, and yet it's an unfinished piece of work.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's still so long, but yet it's unfinished. And in fact, in the prologue, where we meet all the pilgrim characters, the person who's in charge there, the host of the Tabard Inn, he says that everyone is going to tell four stories each, two on the way to Canterbury and two on the way back. And in fact, you know, what we actually get, you know, some of the pilgrims don't tell a tale at all. So we don't get anything like that plan, but we still get a very meaty text. But it's a text that I think Chaucer, I'm not sure he ever really would have finished it exactly. You know, it's the kind of thing you can just keep on working at and adding bits and pieces to.
I think many of us can relate to that, never feeling like your book is quite finished, right? Now, the idea for the Canterbury Tales about people traveling and telling stories is not fully original to Chaucer, right? So where did he get this idea from?
Well, so there are other tale collections, so groups of stories. In lots of different cultures, we see those kinds of texts. So a key example is Boccaccio's Decameron. So Boccaccio's Decameron, which was also written in the 14th century, and Boccaccio, an Italian writer, was one of the main influences on Chaucer. And he has 10 tale tellers who each tell a tale each for 10 days. So you end up with 100 stories. Now, there are a couple of things that are different about the way that Chaucer does it. And the most important is the nature of the tale tellers. So Boccaccio's group, it is actually mainly women. So it's diverse in that way, but it's not diverse in terms of social class. They are all of the same social class, which is a high social class. What Chaucer does is he puts together a really varied group. So we have a knight at the top end of the scale, we have a ploughman at the bottom end of the scale, and in between, we have all kinds of different working people. You know, we have a cook, we have a friar, we have a miller, we have a lawyer. You know, we have lots of different kinds of people. And that's really radical, because what Chaucer is saying there is that we shouldn't just listen to voices of authority. We shouldn't only listen to people from a high social class. We should actually see what people who are coming from different perspectives and different backgrounds have to say. I mean, that's a really radical message, you know, to say, well, actually, let's listen to the monk, whoever would expect us to listen to, but let's also listen to this kind of minor landowner and see what he has to say. And then, you know, let's listen to this merchant and this sailor, you know, let's just hear their perspectives. They're not all going to be right. We're not going to agree with them all, but, you know, we can't make decisions based on only one point of view.
And I love this, because Chaucer is someone who has been in court circles. He is related by marriage to John of Gaunt eventually. So you would think that he would always be writing something that was very courtly, that his audience would be a very courtly audience. So how was this received when he started writing about ordinary people? How did that go?
Well, I think that although he is partly writing for a courtly audience, he's also very much writing for a London audience. So Chaucer straddled different social worlds. He was the son of a merchant, and his main jobs were things like being a customs officer in the city of London. You know, he was also a member of parliament. He was a soldier. He was a prisoner of war at one point. He did lots of different kinds of things. But while some of his poems may have been performed in great households in the court, others were read in inns, in pubs, to mixed groups of people. And some of the earliest evidence that we have for readers of his texts are, you know, relatively middling people in the city, you know, rather than the nobility, who were still mainly reading French texts for pleasure, whereas it's a little bit lower down, not the very bottom of the spectrum, but the middling kind of orders that are more interested in this kind of English poetry. And it was very popular. I mean, you know, of course, this is an era when Chaucer's writing. This is before print. So texts can't circulate in, you know, very widely by our standards. But lots of other poets at the time start responding to his work, quoting from his work. You know, people were immediately, I think, captured by the power of his poetry, by the range of the things that he does. Because really, the genius of writing a tale collection is that there's something for everyone. So someone who wants to read a funny, rude story, go to the Miller's Tale. Someone who wants to read a saint's life, go to the Second Nun's Tale. You can find something depending on what you're interested in.
Yes. Well, I was thinking of this as you're speaking. A long time ago, someone said to me that the average person on the street wouldn't have an idea of what Chaucer was writing because he was reading to the court circles. But I was thinking, even if you are reading to a court circle, you're reading aloud, or someone is reading the work aloud, and there's no way that you don't have servants that are picking up things that are funny from this and telling other people. So even in that case, even if it was in courtly circles, of course, this stuff could get spread around too. At least it seems to me.
Yeah, no, I think that's true, that it does get spread around, and that he is certainly being read not only in that court as well, but he's a city poet as well. And, you know, women as well as men are reading his texts. We have evidence during his lifetime of his books being used to pay debts in taverns, you know, that kind of thing. So they are circulating, you know, not only amongst the very highest group. On the other hand, I mean, it is true to say that your average ploughman working in the fields is not aware of what's going on in literature at the time. Sure, that's true.
Yeah. But you're right. People in the city, London's so cosmopolitan, and it feels like there are lots of people who are kind of plugged into the vibe, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So we've talked about the Canterbury Tales, where it kind of sits. Let's get into the Wife of Bath. So who is this character? How does she appear in the Canterbury Tales?
So in the Canterbury Tales, there's this group of characters who then tell stories. And in the general prologue, so the introduction to the Canterbury Tales, all of the tale tellers, the pilgrims are described. So most of them are men. And the women that are described are nuns, except for the Wife of Bath. So she's the only woman on this pilgrimage, the only tale teller who is not a religious figure, who's not a nun, you know, of some kind. Instead, she is a really kind of interesting, larger than life woman. So she has been married 5 times. She's traveled to Jerusalem and Spain and, you know, all over the world. She's worked in the cloth trade. She's very funny. She makes all kinds of mistakes, you know, and talks a lot about all the inappropriate things that she does. She mocks churchmen and churchmen who often hated women and kind of attacks their misogyny. So she is this extraordinary larger than life character. And, you know, there are so many things about her that are really unprecedented in English literature, because before we get the Wife of Bath, women in medieval literature, you know, they fall into particular types. So you get damsels in distress, princesses, queens. You also get witches, crones, whores, bawds who procure women for others. You get these real stereotyped women. Now, what the Wife of Bath is, I mean, you know, and she is in many ways an extreme figure, but she's also an ordinary woman. She's a woman who works, has sex, is middle-aged, you know, has friends, gossips. She's ordinary in a way that literature did not represent ordinary women before that point. And even, you know, when we think right across time, literature has in general not been very interested in, you know, an older woman who works and has husbands and, you know, wants to do these very ordinary kinds of things. So it's really interesting that Chaucer creates this character. There are sources, but he's changed them dramatically. So the main source for the Wife of Bath is a woman who is an old prostitute. And, you know, Chaucer takes aspects of that character, but changes them dramatically and makes her into someone who is essentially, you know, respectable. I mean, she's extreme, but she's not a prostitute or anything like that. And Chaucer then gives her a really powerful voice. So a voice that is more powerful than the voice of any of his other pilgrims. And that is an incredible thing to do. And the way he does that is that each pilgrim has a prologue before they tell their story. Now, for many of them, the prologue is very short. Mm-hmm. There are 3 that have prologues, which are known as the confessional prologues, because they go into more detail about their lives. But the other 2 pilgrims that do that for kind of 100 or 200 lines. The Wife of Bath does it for over 800 lines. So, you know, she just tells us everything about herself, you know, this extraordinary narrative. So not only is she a very unusual kind of figure, but she's also given a voice and a platform, which is quite different to the voice and platform that are given to the other characters. And I think that is, you know, really why she has been so enduring, because that voice is just really memorable for most readers and listeners, I think.
Yes, one of her strengths seems to be that she can interrupt. But when she interrupts, she's not just throwing out something that is entirely clearly just something out of a bit of misogynistic literature. She's actually debating with many of the thinkers of the time. So can you tell us how she engages with past ideas about what women should be?
Absolutely. So throughout her prologue, she is quite often quoting from misogynist texts, you know, some of which have come from the Bible or from people such as Saint Jerome, some of which have come from, you know, more recent, what's known as anti-feminist texts. You know, there isn't really a concept of feminism in the Middle Ages, but there is a concept of anti-feminism and a big body of anti-woman literature. Now, she is very aware of those texts and she uses them a lot, but she also kind of laughs at them in various ways. You know, she kind of mocks some, you know, so she kind of says, well, you say that virginity is the best thing, but, you know, if everyone were virgins, then where would the virgins come from? You know, she makes a lot of jokes about, you know, that kind of thing. But she also makes very serious points about this body of misogynist literature. So her fifth husband had a book called The Book of Wicked Wives, and she refers to that throughout her prologue as this kind of weight of misogyny, you know, what it feels like to have people always saying these terrible things about you, which you can't argue back to, because there isn't a weight of literature. There isn't a weight of feminist literature. You don't have the tools to respond to. And this is a book that is the cause of domestic violence. You know, eventually, as she tells her story, we hear that her husband kept reading this book and kind of accusing her of these terrible crimes, of being like these women that he's read about in this book. And eventually, you know, she wants to destroy the book, and then he attacks her back, and she is deafened by that blow. So it becomes a very serious point about how literature interacts with life. You know, if people keep saying terrible things about women, what that does to the bodies of actual women. And it's really interesting to think that, you know, in the 14th century, this female character is aware of the problems of a biased canon. And at one point, she steps out of all those sources, which she has come out of herself. And she says, well, who painted the lion? Tell me who. And this is a quotation from a fable. So it's not from these misogynistic texts. It's from a fable about a man and a lion. And people were taught a lot through fables in the Middle Ages. And you could think of different morals, different ways of interpreting the fables. Now, this fable is about a picture of a man killing a lion. And, you know, the lion looks at that picture and says, well, who painted the lion? And the point is, a man has painted this and has made the man look great, like he's the winner. Now, if the lion had painted the picture, it might have shown the lion in control, but the man has had all the power. This was a well-known fable, but people hadn't before applied it to gender. And the wife of Barth says, who painted the lion? In the context of saying, well, all the books have been written by men. And then she says, but if women had had the chance to write stories as men have in their oratories, then they would have said all about the wickedness of men. And this is a thing that writers have been saying, you know, right across the centuries. You know, when we get into the 20th century and Virginia Woolf writes her feminist tract, A Room of One's Own, you know, she writes in there about the fact that women have not had the opportunity to be authors. You know, she imagines, what if Shakespeare had had a sister just as clever as he was, and says, well, she would not have been able to succeed in that world because there just have not been those opportunities for female writers. And right across time, people have been aware of this. And when we hear the wife of Barth saying this, I mean, I think it, of course, things have improved a lot, but it still strikes a bit true, you know, the fact that women still don't get their voices heard in many areas as much as men do. And so it's very prescient, a lot of the things that she says in that prologue.
Yes. I mean, for people who have listened to this podcast for years, they've heard me talk about Christine de Pisan, and she wrote The City of Ladies, which is a rejection of this kind of stuff. But the wife of Bath's appearance in literature predates that. So she's earlier than that. Yeah. So for the people who are listening, this is earlier.
But I'm really glad you mentioned Christine de Pizan. So yeah, it is earlier, just kind of 15, 20 years earlier. And of course, you know, if we had a debate about them, of course, Christine is a real woman, which is interesting, whereas the wife of Barth is a fictional woman. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I try and do in my book about the wife of Barth is to use her fictional story as a way then to tell the stories of lots and lots of real medieval women. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I found really productive about focusing on a character was that then allows me to kind of spin out into, well, let me think about lots of different women who are like her, that might have inspired her, or that came a bit later, but that demonstrate some of the same traits that she demonstrated. You know, so I have chapters about much married women, about working women, about storytelling women, such as Christine, about traveling women, for example. And, you know, it was really interesting just to delve into the real lives of real medieval women, you know, lots of real medieval women, and think about how their experiences compare with the experiences of this fictional and extraordinary female character.
Yes. And I think one of the things that you mentioned in the book is that in the time since, one of the things that she as a character gets most criticized about is the fact that she's a lusty woman. She's been married 5 times. When you talk about in the book, the actual truth is this is a very respectable thing for her to be doing. So tell us about the much married in the Middle Ages.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and one of the things that there's a really interesting clash, I think, between a kind of biblical religious idea, which you know, the church fathers talked about, you know, 1,000 years before Chaucer, where they were kind of saying, oh, you know, it's evil to marry twice and it's better to be single. And, you know, those things to many of us today sound extremely old fashioned. And they also sounded very old fashioned to Chaucer. And that's, I think, what's really important, that when the wife of Bath is quoting those things, that's not the medieval norm. Whereas I think for readers today, it's easy to think that because we're so distanced from that world. But in fact, no one thought like that in Chaucer's world. So although, of course, marrying five times is, you know, more than most women at that time, but there are lots of very, very respectable women who were married many times. So I tell the story of, say, the daughter of an important London merchant who married four times and inherited, you know, a great deal of money and property from all of her husbands. I tell the story of a 15th century widow who was, in fact, a relation of Chaucer's, a couple of generations on, who married four husbands. And her last husband, she married when she was 65 and he was a teenager. You know, it was known as a kind of diabolical marriage at the time, but it did happen. You know, many women would move from one husband to the next. And one reason they were able to do this was that England had good inheritance laws at this time. So at the same time, in some other parts of Europe, such as Italy, there was no incentive to marry again. In fact, there was a disincentive. You know, if you did that, you would lose your dowry, for example. You would probably lose your children as well. So you were incentivized to stay with your husband's family if you wanted to keep or to go back to your own father, but not to marry again. In England, people, you know, women could remarry and keep a lot of their inheritance and go on earning money. So there wasn't the same problem with getting remarried. And widows were often very wealthy, particularly in the city. They could also go on running businesses. They could control property. A lot of things that people don't think medieval women would have been able to do, actually, they were. And we see women who were skinners and blacksmiths and scribes and business owners who employed apprentices. I mean, of course, you know, one can go too far down that route. I don't want to idealize what life was like for medieval women. But I think it is important to note that it was much better than people often assume. You know, people often imagine a kind of dark ages where women could not work and were in the home all the time. And that's not the case for medieval England at all.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so glad that you mentioned that. So we were talking about being married a lot, and it's much easier to see in the aristocracy. But as you're saying, this is something that's pretty common to working women. So how were working women viewed at this time? Were they abominations, people who are working in the marketplace, or were they just a normal part of society that people almost didn't notice?
Absolutely normal part of society that people did not notice. A very large proportion of women worked at this time in many different areas of life. And, you know, one really interesting thing about medieval marriage patterns is that men and women tended to marry relatively late. So again, there were other parts of Europe where girls are marrying at 12, 13. Although girls could marry at 12, and that's what we're told the wife of Bath has done. In fact, women did not usually marry till many years later, you know, more like 20, early 20s. Part of the reason why was that they would earn money before they got married. And so because men and women would not usually live in the family home, there was a custom which is known as neo-locality, so forming a new household on your marriage. And if you want to do that, you know, for most people, both the man and the woman would have to work to earn money in order to be able to set up that new household. So in the lower levels of English society, many women would work, I mean, particularly in things like domestic service or as apprentices, you know, in different kinds of trades, in the food trade, in cloth and weaving, silk trades, those kinds of things. Higher up the scale, women could indeed own their own businesses, help run their husband's businesses, and then maybe take them over if their husband died before they did. And aristocratic women would often be expected to be able to run the estate, to buy land, to negotiate at that kind of level. So I think that we really are looking at a world where female work is something which is empowering for women and is normal. And, you know, when I first started reading about all these fascinating medieval women, you know, first of all, I think for us, you kind of think, well, you know, being a domestic servant, we have an instinctive sense that that is not a good role in life. You know, most of us would not think that that was a good position for a woman to be in. But I think we have to look at context. And actually, when we look at other societies at the time in other parts of the world where essentially the work of a household is simply done by unpaid daughters, sisters, daughters-in-law who are doing all the domestic work and not being paid and not having any freedom to go out and get jobs and make decisions, it's clearly much better to be given a wage and to be able to leave an employer in certain circumstances and to be able to save money for what you want to do. So I think domestic service was actually a very empowering thing in English society. And yeah, I mean, I know you've read the book, Danielle, so you'll have seen that I have some I think great stories about particularly, you know, Marjorie Kemp's maid who sets off around Europe with her, you know, gets sick of being a maid for this employer who everyone finds quite annoying, you know, leaves her. I mean, she was clearly quite an unscrupulous and ambitious woman. You know, leaves her employer, and then her employer finds her in Rome, and this servant girl has managed to get a really good job as cellarer, in charge of the cellars, the wine, at the English Hospice in Rome, which is a very kind of prestigious, large kind of hotel establishment. And this girl now gives charity to her former employer, having really bettered herself through travel and through work. And you know, I mean, I'm not sure that this is a woman that you'd want to meet on a dark night, but it's a very interesting example of the way that women could live, you know, interesting and unexpected lives and could seize opportunities, and that those opportunities were there for them to seize.
I love that. And in writing my own book that's I'm still working on right now, I've been thinking about domestic service and thinking about this as almost being an apprenticeship, right? Because these women are they're earning money, as you say, and they're learning how to run a household while they're doing it. Do I want to be a domestic servant? Not really. I'm sure that was very difficult, but it was also an opportunity, as you say, for them to learn stuff. And then society at large expected these women to have capabilities. So even though you have many bits of literature, they're setting up women to be kind of helpless. Only rarely do you have one that's very witty and can usually facilitate marriage or something like that. Here in the Canterbury Tales, you have a very realistic woman who is perfectly capable and confident. She knows she's capable. And I think that is one of the things that perhaps people have an issue with in the later centuries, if not the actual pilgrims themselves, because they do make fun of her a little bit during the story.
Yeah, and some of the other male pilgrims, you know, they interrupt her. They don't want to hear from her. But she kind of slaps them down and goes on talking. But it's really important that, you know, she's absolutely not presented as some kind of ideal character or as a character that should be admired in every way or anything like that. You know, she is a flawed character, and we're allowed to think all kinds of different things about her. But across time, people have definitely been both fascinated and horrified by her in equal measure, I'd say.
Yes, I do want to get to that in a second, because I think that legacy is very important. But I don't think we've mentioned, what is the tale that she tells? What is she trying to get across?
Yeah, thank you. So, I mean, The Wife of Bath's Tale is actually the story that the modern film Shrek is based on, the Loathly Lady story. So the story of an old woman that transforms into a young and beautiful woman, which was a much told story in the Middle Ages. Now, it begins with a knight. And if you are a medieval reader, as you hear a story about a knight, you are expecting him to go and do a brave deed. You know, maybe he'll rescue a damsel. Maybe he'll do really well in a fight. You know, he's probably going to ride around on his horse. But this knight is a rapist, and we're told that very early on in the story. So we have this immediate shock to our expectation of, oh, this is what knights are doing sometimes when they're riding around with all this power. And the story is then about how this rapist is punished and reformed. So the king wants to execute him. The queen says, no, give the punishment to me and my ladies. And they say, right, you have to go off and find out what women want. So it's a real punishment that fits the crime. This is someone who has made it clear that he does not care what women want. He does not think women's desire matters at all. And they say, go away and think about it for a year. So he goes away, and, you know, eventually he meets this magical, fairy, ugly old woman who tells him the answer, but says, you know, you have to promise to do what I want if I give you the answer. And the answer is that they want mastery. They want power. But he has given this promise, and what she wants is for him to marry her. Now, he's absolutely horrified, but he has to marry her. And she then gives a very long and powerful lecture to him about ethics. And absolutely extraordinary that the ethical center of this story is an ugly, old, poor woman. We expect the ethical center of a story to be the young, handsome knight. That's what people expect at that time. And it's not. It's the old, ugly, poor woman. And she then teaches him about Christian ethics, about the problem of his value system, about the fact that he thinks about appearances, not depth. And eventually, you know, he is apparently won round and says, okay. And she says, okay, now you can choose whether you want to have me young and beautiful and maybe faithless to you, or old and ugly, but a good, faithful wife, which is incidentally a very misogynist kind of choice. But that's the choice she gives him. And he said, you choose. And she says, okay, well, as you've given me the power, you can have it all. I'm going to be young, beautiful, and faithful. So it's a very curious story. It upsets a lot of expectations. It also, in some ways, ends up falling into this pattern where, you know, in some ways you think, but the rapist has ended up with the young, beautiful, obedient wife. And that's quite uncomfortable. You know, there's a lot of different things going on about gender, about power relations, about age, about beauty. And I think one of the interesting things about this fascinating story is that we kind of get two endings. So we get the ending that I just told you about, which is the, and then she was young and beautiful and she obeyed him and everything. And then immediately the wife of Barth says, but I want God to give us women husbands that will always be obedient to us and will punish them with the plague if they ever go against us. So she kind of, you know, says, well, you know, in this story, I kind of know that stories have to end with a happy ending. But in my real life, that's not what I want. You know, I actually want men to be subservient to me. So she gives us another extreme and leaves it kind of open and uncomfortable at the end. But I mean, so interesting that we have this story which really makes people think about the realities of rape and makes this man think about what it means to be violated in that way and to have your free will removed. There's a very powerful moment when he kind of says to the old woman, you know, take all my goods and let my body go. And he has realized that losing autonomy over your body, over your desires, over your sexual life is really one of the worst possible things that you can do to someone.
So reading this from our place in 2023, when this episode is coming out, it is a very uncomfortable story. How do you think readers and audiences reacted at the time to this? Because I think you could read it in many different ways. Do you have a sense of how that was received?
Yeah, and it's really interesting to note that there are other versions of this story at the time, and they just are nothing like as radical as Chaucer's. So in the other versions, the knight is not a rapist. The crime that he commits is not a real crime. So Chaucer is really doing something very deliberate with this story in condemning the knight in that way. So we have scribal comments and so on next to the tale, but we don't have much direct evidence from the very moment of its being produced in terms of what people were thinking about it specifically. But quite early on in its reception history, we do start to get people being fascinated with the wife of Barth and with her tale. So it is something that is one of the tales that most kind of grabs people's attention from early on. But we have to be quite speculative, I think, in trying to think about what people thought about it at the moment of its production.
And this is important. I don't want to get too much into the new understanding of Chaucer's perhaps crime. We are not sure what he was up to with Cecily Champagne. So I don't want to get into that too much. But if you are uncomfortable reading it now, I think that's fair. I think everybody has been a little bit uncomfortable reading this story, and it's meant to be disruptive. And I think it will continue to be disruptive as we continue to read it. So maybe this is a good opportunity to get into the reception of The Wife of Bath, both her prologue and the story, over time, because people have kind of lost their minds over this over time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting because, you know, when I first came up with the idea for this book, where, you know, the first half is the medieval wife of Barth, and where she comes from, why does this character emerge at this time, interweaving the story with real medieval women. And then the second half is reception across time. So from kind of 1400 up to 2021, you know, I knew there'd be lots of good examples. But then the more research I was doing, I was thinking, every single author that I can think of has written a version of The Wife of Bath. This is absolutely amazing. And, you know, the book goes through Skelton, Shakespeare, Voltaire, Pope, Dryden, Gay, James Joyce, Zadie Smith, Ted Hughes, Patience Ag-Bagby, as well as filmmakers, you know, people like Pasolini. I mean, she's just absolutely everywhere. And it's just so interesting because I really cannot think of any other character from English literature that's had that kind of reach. I think we can see comparable influence with kind of mythical figures such as King Arthur or classical figures such as Odysseus or Dido. But it's really, really unusual to have a kind of character invented by an author like this who then just takes off in this way. So that, you know, from very early on, readers will be, you know, they'll be writing poems about the Canterbury Tales. You know, Skelton does this and he writes, you know, four lines about the rest of the Canterbury Tales and then 10 about The Wife of Bath, for example. And what, you know, a really interesting early example is that this is very popular ballad about the Wife of Bath, and it was burnt, and the printers were put in prison because people were so. And this is in 1600 and then 1632, and people were so threatened by this, you know, woman who was in the ballad is talking back to saints and patriarchs at the gate of heaven. And yeah, I mean, the books were literally being burnt. And then later on, so I mean, you asked about both the prologue and tale. So I'll give you some examples from both. So the prologue, a really interesting example of that would be what Pope does, where so Alexander Pope, where he writes a version and he just basically takes the sex out. So he takes out the references to genitalia and having sex in the morning and, you know, where she talks about her quoniam or her chamber of Venus. You know, that all just gets taken out. So lots of the kind of, you know, funny, risque aspects of her voice are just removed from the text completely. With the tale, another 18th century example is Voltaire in France, who writes a version of the tale. And, you know, it's really disturbing because he implies that the rape victim actually kind of wanted it, wasn't really very bothered by it. And there's this extraordinary, you know, turnaround of the focus of the tale. So that at the end, when the knight, who really is much more of a hero in Voltaire's version, his name is Robert, when he has to have sex with the old ugly woman, it's turned into this amazing chivalric feat. And we're told all about how incredible his bravery is in having sex with this old woman and how, you know, what glory it is that he actually manages it. And there's this a major focus on his erection where he just says, I absolutely cannot. And she's kind of saying, no, you're young, you're healthy, you're strong, you will be able to. And then he really kind of screws up his courage and eventually he manages it. So this story, which is a story about, you know, the ethical power of female speech and making a rapist think about what he's done, becomes this valorization of the male erection. I mean, It's deeply, deeply disturbing, obviously. Yeah, so right across time, we see versions of both prologue and tale, you know, sometimes the two of them kind of spliced together, and, you know, lots of different ways in which this text is adapted. So things like sometimes just one is either prologue or tale is translated, but sometimes, you know, we get things like an early 20th century play in America that is this kind of spin-off, I suppose, you know, so tells new stories but about the Wife of Bath and ends, you know, she's trying to marry Chaucer, but she ends up being beaten, essentially, metaphorically beaten by the men who manage to trick her so that she ends up being forced to marry the miller because they make up a new law that says, you know, you can only marry a miller for your sixth husband. And everyone laughs at the Wife of Bath who's been cheated. You know, so really bizarre, bizarre things. And I suppose I also think it's very interesting the way you see people using the Wife of Bath sometimes to write about their own lives. So Ted Hughes is a really interesting example where he writes about his lover, Sylvia Plath, as if she is the Wife of Bath and writes about her reciting the Wife of Bath's prologue and says that the Wife of Bath was her favorite character in all literature and then imagines her, you know, speaking in this endless way like the Wife of Bath. So I think that kind of imaginative putting the Wife of Bath into your own life is quite an interesting response as well.
Mm-hmm. Although I have to say, and you mentioned this too in the book, that always makes me very uncomfortable, that comparison of Sylvia Plath. She's supposed to be speaking to cows.
Yeah.
And he kind of distances himself as if he's watching her doing something that's kind of ridiculous when really
Exactly.
Dismissing her speech. It makes me very uncomfortable to
Yeah,
read
me
that
too.
one.
And then he drives the cows off, and he's the kind of capable man who can come in. So I think it's absolutely a, I think on the scale of what's done with the wife of Bath, it's on the lighter end of the disparagement scale, right? So it's a kind of, he's showing that he's quite superior to her. It's not the viciousness of someone like Pasolini, who depicts sex with the wife of Bath as actually causing men literally to die. That's how horrified he is by older female sexuality and a dominant female voice. And that's, I suppose, the more extreme end of the scale. But someone like Hughes as well, I think I agree that it's very, there's something really sinister about it. And it's this putting the wife of Bath in her place, and at the same time putting Sylvia Plath in her place. And that's what we often see, I think, a kind of, well, we'll contain this figure. But of course, the glorious thing is that she really can't be contained. She always, they burn the ballads, they never find all the copies. The ballad keeps going. Pope tries to cut this tale, but of course, the real version, the full version of the prologue still circulates. People don't actually succeed in silencing her voice because her voice is so powerful and so strong.
I love that. And I'm glad that you in the book and here on the podcast have talked about the way she's been received in the time since. Because again, not valorizing the lives of women in the 14th century, which were still difficult in many ways, she was better received in some ways. Her book, the prologue, her tale, they weren't burned in the 14th century, but later people got much more uncomfortable with it. And I think that just really speaks to so many myths of the Middle Ages to begin with.
Absolutely. I mean, and people were not uncomfortable talking about sex in the Middle Ages. The way that, we see at times in the 18th and 19th century, much more, discomfort with the kind of explicit sexual language that the wife of Bath is using. When Dryden says, I really, really wanted to translate the wife of Bath, but I didn't dare to. It's too licentious. I mean, no one thought that in the Middle Ages at all. And one of the really sobering things, I think, when you trace something like this across time, but really, really important, is that things do not steadily progress and improve in anything in history. And it's still a myth that a lot of people do unconsciously, I think, believe that there's a general improvement in things, that women's rights generally get better, that democracy has generally become fairer. Now, many of us in recent years have really seen that it's very clear that that is not the case everywhere in the world, that there are places at the moment where women's rights are going backwards, for example. But when you look at the reception of the wife of Bath, many of the responses in the 20th century are the most misogynist responses across time. And I think that 15th century scribes were often responding in negative ways, but they were more focused on trying to combat her rhetorical power, for example. In the 20th century, there was often, we see this really visceral horror at her body, her sexuality, and a real kind of disturbingly aggressive focus on that body and sexuality. So I think it's an important history lesson for anyone actually to remember that things go up and down. They go down and up. We don't always see improvement across time. But I mean, I liked the fact that the arc of the book, I think, could truthfully reflect this, that I could end with what I think is quite an optimistic note, because in the last 20 years, the Wife of Bath's prologue and tale has been very much reclaimed, particularly by female voices. And before that, there hadn't been that many female voices reinterpreting the Wife of Bath. There had been some, but they've really dominated the last couple of decades. And in particular, lots of women of color have written new versions of The Wife of Bath's prologue and tale. And we're seeing new versions, I think, which are very true to the spirit of what Chaucer was doing, but are also really boldly creative about doing something new. So I'm thinking about Caroline Bergvall, and then about Jean Binta Breeze, Patience Ag-Bagby, and most famously, Zadie Smith's Wife of Willesden play, which I think are just really extraordinary and exciting new interpretations, and really demonstrate to people how alive medieval literature still is today in all kinds of ways and settings.
Yes. And I like this because it's giving the lion the paintbrush, right?
Absolutely.
Well, we could talk about this for so long, but we should probably wrap up with this. But I really want to thank you so much, Marion, for coming on and talking about the Wife of Bath, because as the book that you've written shows, she just is somebody who can't be contained and just has this explosive, the word that people often use is that she's vital. She's got this vitality that has really kind of shaped culture in many ways. So thank you so much for coming on to tell us more about The Wife of Bath.
Oh, it's been my absolute pleasure, Danielle. And I'm glad you ended on that note of vitality, because I think that is probably one of the most important words for people to think about, that there is something life-affirming about the text and its survival and what people are doing with it. And, you know, I think it's great to encourage people to engage with the text and to be creative with Chaucer's texts, because they are still alive today. So thank you.
Yes. To find out more about Marion's work, you can visit her faculty webpage at english.ox.ac.uk/people/Dr.Marion-Turner. Her new book, The Wife of Bath, a Biography, is hot off the press this week from Princeton University. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey, hey. Well, I decided that for this year, I would do something different with our new medieval books section. So previously, I did these kind of roundups where I kind of brought together five different books and talked a little bit about each of them. And now I'm doing one book at a time and trying to give more details about the book and who it might be a good reader for. So I'm really happy about that. And so we've done a few of these books so far. And one of the latest ones that we featured is called The History of the Nation of Archers. It's a translation of a 13th century Armenian account of the Mongols and their invasion of the Middle East. And I bring this up because the translator is a guy named Robert Bedrosian. And he's kind of like a pioneer in online medieval studies. So about like 25, 27 years ago, he set up his own website and he published a number of medieval translations, including this one. And so you can find them on at several places online, but this is kind of the first time it's actually been in a printed book form. So as someone who kind of admires that kind of work from way back when and that kind of contribution, like I just wanted to highlight that. I was excited to see it.
Yeah. Well, congratulations to him. I don't know him personally, but that is awesome. I think it's great that you have people that were being so generous 25, 27 years ago online, and now a print version, I think, hopefully could reach even more people. So congrats to him.
Yeah, yeah. He's certainly like back then kind of creating resources, creating articles and translated texts and doing that kind of stuff. It was innovative stuff and showed where people can go with it. So yeah. Plus we look at the bog bodies in Europe and a study on the health of people living in the early Middle Ages in this early medieval community in Germany. Spoiler, they were like riddled with disease.
I mean, that's kind of expected. This is why I don't want to time travel myself. I'll just look at it from a distance. Thank you very much.
Indeed.
Thanks. Okay, so before I let you go, how often can people find new medieval books featured on medievalist.net? And are you featuring them just on the website or on social media as well?
Oh, we're trying to aim to do 5 books a week, and we have posts. Plus, we're doing a lot on social media, posting photos of the books, photos of some of their pages so you can have a look inside. We're doing a lot on Instagram with them, and you can also see that hopefully in other places like TikTok.
Awesome. So people can discover them every day. Awesome. That's great. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to all of the patrons on medievalist.net's Patreon page. Your patronage supports this podcast as well as other work by independent medieval historians, writers, and podcasters. In addition to seriously good karma, patrons have access to all sorts of great stuff like subscriptions to the Medieval Magazine and Medieval World Magazine, as well as ad-free versions of this podcast. To get in on the action, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from The Wife of Bath to types of baths, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5MIN Medievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books at all your favorite bookstores, where you can get hold of How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.